This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
What I would like to do today is talk, give you sort of a very selective overview of the epidemiology of autism spectrum disorder. I'm not going to try to be comprehensive at all, but I highlight a few of the things that I think, a few important developments. And then I'd like to talk about some of the limitations in the epidemiology of autism and that we really have to correct and do a better job at if we're going to make progress in understanding this disease. And one of these limitations is just where the studies of autism are conducted, and the populations that are included in epidemiologic studies of autism are it's very much focused on high-income countries, and even within high-income countries, most of what we know is based on relatively affluent populations. And so that's one thing. But the other thing is that the epidemiology of autism has used a very sort of an outdated model of disability, focusing just on the impairment dimension of disability. But when you work internationally, you're exposed to the ICF, the International Classification of Functioning, which puts as much or more weight on the functional dimension of disability and the degree to which people participate in society, and that becomes much more important. And in our studies of the epidemiology of autism, we don't really focus on that very much at all, so I want to try to bring that up in my comments. Now, I'm assuming that many of you are not epidemiologists, so I know that I heard from the postdocs that you do get a fair amount of training in epidemiology, which is really impressive. But I'd like to just start by defining what we mean by what epidemiology is. And the most common definition is that it's the study of the frequency and distribution of diseases and other health outcomes in populations. And we emphasize that word population for a number of reasons. One of them is that instead of just studying the frequency in a particular clinic where you might get a very biased view of what the disease looks like, we try to identify all the cases occurring in the population. And when we do that, we can, you might get a much less, more representative view anyway of the disease. For example, if you study autism in a particular clinic where you need to have insurance or a specific type of insurance to get services there, you might infer that, gee, everybody with autism has good insurance or the characteristics that go along with good insurance. That would be just one example of a bias. Another is if that clinic is a referral center for certain genetic disorders, you might think, gee, those disorders are really frequent in children with autism. It may not really be true if you look at the whole population. So that's one reason. The other is that when you study the disease in the population, you have like a built-in control group that's unbiased so that you can compare the characteristics of persons with autism to the others in the population. That's how we try to identify risk factors for the disease and things like that. And then another point is that sort of a basic idea in public health is the idea of the common good. And so that we should be trying to figure out what's good for the whole population rather than just individuals. And in some ways, you might think that then epidemiology and public health is in contrast to individualized medicine. But I think, in fact, it doesn't have to be that way, because as long as we can figure out ways of delivering personalized medicine and targeted therapies and make them available to everybody in the population and distribute it equitably, then that would be very good for public health. But until we can figure out how to do that, it's very different from the public health approach where we're trying to figure out what's going to be the best way to use resources to serve the population overall. And then there are a number, what I'll try to highlight in my comments about the epidemiology of autism is how it can be used to serve a number of these purposes which are listed here, determining prevalence, service needs, and causes, and so on and so forth. So without a doubt, the most remarkable development in noteworthy in the epidemiology of autism in the last 50 years has been the dramatic increase in the numbers of children. The first epidemiologic study ever conducted was in England in the 1960s, and the first in the United States was in Wisconsin, published in 1970. It's shown here, you can't even see the bar because it's so small, but that red right there, it was about three, and I'll show a slide on that, about 3 per 10,000 children were affected. And what we've seen over the years, beginning in the 1990s, was a gradual increase, and the highest prevalence ever reported is this 2.6 from South Korea that was published in 2011. Basically, all over the world, European countries, where the studies are being done, we're finding much higher prevalence in these recent years. And every time we measure it, it's one of the things that every time we measure it, it goes up. What's shown here in red are the studies from the United States, North America. This is our most recent result from the CDC that we issued last week, where now we're finding basically 1.5% of children 8 years old meet criteria for an autism spectrum disorder. So I want to just highlight a few. This is the first study in the United States conducted in Wisconsin by Daryl Treffert. And at the time, he did this work really in the 60s, published it in 1970. But most of the children with autism were in institutions at that time. And he went around the state and he reviewed the records and confirmed the diagnosis. And he found in the entire state 280 cases, and this is from a broad age range, 3 to 12 years, corresponding to a prevalence of about 3.1 per 10,000. He did find this elevated sex ratio. Since then, this is showing the most recent data from the CDC. We have, you know, dramatically increased. I mean, now that we're seeing more, we only look at 8-year-old children, and we're seeing many more 8-year-old children than he saw of all ages. It's about 50 times more prevalent in Wisconsin only than it was in this, based on this 1970 report. Now, what this shows is just the CDC is the effort in the United States that was initiated in 2000. It was called for a part of the Children's Health Act of 2000, which was the result largely of advocacy by parents of children with autism to try to... The CDC hadn't been looking at autism before that at all. We had no real national effort to monitor the prevalence, and they put in the Children's Health Act that the CDC must begin monitoring of autism in the population. And these data show every 2 years we issue a report. And you can see that our first couple reports, it was 1 in 150, and that was the number. And then every time we've looked at it since then, the prevalence increases. So whether you describe it as 1 in 68, our most recent numbers, or 14.7 per 1,000, same thing. Basically 1.5% of children meeting criteria. Since the diagnostic criteria and the methodology for conducting this surveillance has not changed at all over this time period, we can't really attribute the change to change in methodology or diagnostic criteria. But that one number that you get, the 1 in 68 or the 15%, 15 per 1,000, 1.5%, it actually hides a great deal of variability. There's quite a bit of site-to-site variation in the prevalence. There's 11 sites across the country participating in our most recent report. And you can see that in Alabama, it's just over 5 per 1,000 or 0.5%. And in New Jersey, it's well over 20, so it's over 2% of children in New Jersey. And then in between is quite a range. We think that this has to do... since the methodology, the criteria are the same, we don't think it's that, but in order to come into attention, a child has to have had some sort of a developmental assessment or received services for developmental disability or special education, that sort of thing. And that can vary quite a bit across communities in the country. And so that we see in Alabama, particularly low percentage of children receiving that. This shows how the trends over time in our surveillance data look for sex, and basically in every year that we look at it, we see here's a male versus female. It's about 4.5 males identified with autism for every girl, and that's been a consistent finding, and the increase is occurring in both groups, but the relative male-to-female ratio is staying constant. And then we've also found pretty consistently and it's, I don't have the 2010 data, but similar. What we're finding is that the highest prevalence in non-Hispanic white children, the lowest in Hispanic children, and then African-American children are in between, black and red. And that's been also a pretty consistent finding in our surveillance data. Could well be due to differences in access to services. And I will talk more about that as we go along. Another sort of trend in the epidemiology of autism over the years is that we're seeing the proportion of children that are classified as having intellectual disability within the children with autism has declined. And one of the things, what this shows is, this is from a systematic review of autism prevalence studies, and in green it's the prevalence of autism with intellectual disability. In red, these are the prevalence without intellectual disability. And you can see that much of the increase over these recent decade has been in children without intellectual disability. And so if you like summarize this overall, you see that before 2000, epidemiologic studies would conclude that about two-thirds of children with autism also have intellectual disability. And since 2000, it's reversed, and only about one-third of children with autism have an IQ below 70 if it's measured in that way. And I don't really know why this is. I don't know that anybody does, but it seems to be a consistent finding, something that we're seeing. And whether it has to do with the interventions, and I just had a chance to talk with Sally Rogers about the dramatic IQ improvements in children receiving services for autism, which is, you know, whether that could be something that that this could be a treatment effect, or whether we're just finding more autism in children without intellectual disability, something that I don't understand. We don't really know why this is, but something of note anyway in the epidemiology. Other developments in the epidemiology of autism spectrum disorder are, I've listed some of them here. One is that a really consistent finding is the increased prevalence of autism associated with both maternal age and paternal age. For a while, it was thought, some studies suggested it was the father's age that was more important. Other studies suggested it's the mother's age. But when we finally had large enough studies to be able to control for one parent's age and study the effect independently of the other parent, we're seeing that it's really both parents' age that contribute, and they do it in a sort of an additive way. And I'll show a slide on that in a moment. Maybe I'll skip to that here and come back. So these are the results from our analysis of the ADAM data some years ago, where we saw that, I'll just point here the odds ratios. This was a replication of a study done here in California based on the Kaiser Permanente that Lisa Krohn and colleagues did. And we found almost identical results to theirs, which is basically that for the mother's age, and these are adjusted odds ratios, for mothers over 35, the odds is about 1.3, so their risk of autism in offspring of mothers over 35 is about 30% higher than mothers in the reference age range, 20 to 29 years. And for fathers, and this is adjusted for mother's age, the paternal age effect doesn't really show up until after age 40. And then offspring of fathers over age 40 have about a 40% increase of risk of autism. This is basic finding's been replicated now in many studies, and so we, in epidemiology, we begin to believe it after we see it over and over again, different populations, different methods. The other thing is we found, and this isn't as consistent a finding across studies, but a number of studies find that the highest risk of autism is in the firstborn child. And in our surveillance data, we definitely find that. So this is the prevalence in firstborn, and then it declines with each birth order after that. And these effects are additive. So actually, if you are a male child, you're the firstborn of both older parents, the risk of autism is 8 times higher than if you're a girl and later born and not of older parents, that kind of thing. So each of these adds an effect. And this is important for a number of reasons. I mean, I think one of them is that it does provide some clues to etiology. We were, in doing these studies, we were kind of hoping it would be either the mother or the father, not both, because that might help narrow the search for causal mechanisms. But the fact that it's both, it really opens it up to being both, either these mutations, copy number mutations that are more common in male associated with father's aging, or a host of maternal complications that increase in frequency as mother's age, and so or chromosomal anomalies, that kind of thing. So we really, it opens up all kinds of possibilities. But there's also public health implications because the age of parenting has increased and dramatically in recent decades, around the same time period that the autism prevalence is increasing. The proportion of births to women over 35 has tripled since the 1970s. So that kind of effect, to what extent could this be contributing to the increase in prevalence, we don't know. But it's as dramatic as it is, it's not as dramatic as the rise in prevalence. So there's got to be other things contributing as well. I'm going to backing up some of the other developments in the epidemiology of autism are the findings of prenatal and perinatal risk factors. In the earlier studies of autism from the 1960s, they really didn't find things like preterm birth to be consistently associated with autism. But all of the recent studies do. So as we're identifying more children in the population with autism, we're seeing a pretty consistent finding. Babies who are born very prematurely or at low birth weight have a higher risk of autism. One of the other things we're finding is that the interpregnancy interval, the interval between the first child's born when the onset of the next pregnancy, the shorter that is, the higher the risk of autism in offspring. So this is something that's sort of a new development. As the prevalence is increasing, we're seeing more of these measurable perinatal risk factors. There's been obviously an explosion of knowledge about specific gene mutations and their association with autism. And some of this is consistent because a lot of them find the copy number mutations, which increase with paternal age, are some of the factors contributing. So it supports that mechanism possibly. And then there's also, because the known genetic factors don't explain all of the cases of autism, there's increasing interest in environmental exposures and so much knowledge about the vulnerability of the developing brain to environmental toxins. We know a lot, but we don't really know how much of that is contributing to autism and the increase in autism. But, of course, this is an active area of research here at UC Davis with Irva Hirsch-Pichota's group. There's a number of discoveries coming out every day, and that's a major area in epidemiology. And also want to mention, in epidemiologic studies, there's an interest in what are the potential effects of the changes in diagnostic criteria and how is that going to affect prevalence, and I'll mention a little bit about that. Let me skip. Just going back to the risk factors, though, this slide kind of summarizes we don't have a single explanation for the rise in prevalence, but we think some of it could be due to changes in the risk factors in the population. And even though some people say, well, genetic factors couldn't have contributed, they don't change so quickly, have any relationship to the rising prevalence. But in fact, both with the copy number mutation mechanism, that could happen in a relatively short time frame with increasing father's age. There's also epigenetic mechanisms that could be so related. And then it's been suggested that assortative mating could be a factor, that people who are parents who might be on the autism spectrum or have a likelihood of having a child with autism might be more likely to meet each other in educational and occupational environments and with the internet and that sort of thing. So it's been suggested that that is a mechanism. So we can't say for sure that there are no genetic explanations for the rise. There's environmental, which we discussed in the perinatal. And then one of the things we did was we put all this together based on at least the perinatal risk factors like parents' age and low birth weight that have been pretty much consistently shown to be associated with increased risk of autism. But when we put it all together, it doesn't explain more than about 2 or 3% of the rise in prevalence. So there's still much more to be learned. And that like points to all these other reasons why the prevalence, what we're measuring as the prevalence of autism, could be increasing, and That we mentioned, I mentioned that the expansion of the diagnostic criteria, that really occurred more in the 1980s for autism, and then the rise. But you don't expect a change immediately. I think the rise in prevalence that we've seen since, some of it is resulting from the gradual adoption of those criteria and development of tools to implement them. Also, the autism as a category for receiving special education services didn't exist in the United States until 1992. And so some of the data that's been used to say that, gee, we have an epidemic of autism, it must be the vaccines or something like that, were those educational data. And really what the best explanation for those increases was the fact that school districts across the country gradually adopted it. They don't do it overnight. And each year, as more and more school districts are providing services for autism, we were seeing rising number of children being classified in the schools with autism. But we don't think that's necessarily a rise in prevalence, but a rise in access to services. There's been tremendous increase in awareness of autism that could be giving rise to this increase. And then also in the diagnostic practices. There's this concept of diagnostic substitution, which I'll give some examples of, which is the idea that children we used to classify as intellectually disabled, now we're getting the autism diagnosis. There's diagnostic accretion, which is the idea that in the past we would have, for example, if a child had Down syndrome, they wouldn't even be evaluated for autism, typically. You wouldn't think of making both diagnoses in a child. That's not true anymore. So a child can accrue many diagnoses, much more than in the past, and that could be contributing to these rising numbers as well. And then we have much better tools, more reliable tools than we've ever had in the past, and trained people to use them, so that those things could be contributing to the rising numbers. Also, the expansion of screening since AAP's recommendation in 2006 that all children be screened for autism at regular pediatric visits, to what extent could that be in contributing to the rising numbers of children identified? These are all possibilities. I mentioned diagnostic substitution, and I think this, it's hard to look at this graph without seeing that there must be some of this going on. These are school data from Wisconsin, and in yellow, it's the number of children receiving services for autism. In red, it's the number of children receiving for cognitive disability. I know when I was trained in psychiatric epidemiology back in the 1980s, we were taught autism is extremely rare. A pediatrician might, in their whole career, not have a patient with autism, but intellectual disability is really common. And if I had suggested that these lines would cross someday, and by 2014, we'd have more children being diagnosed with autism than cognitive disability in the schools, nobody would have believed it, I think, at the time. But this is a sea change that's occurred and must be somehow contributing. This is another indication of diagnostic substitution. But basically, these are data from the Social Security Administration in the U.S., and it's over time from the 1990 to 2010. This is the percent. It adds up to 100%. And in 1990, this is the majority of children receiving Social Security SSI payments because they have a child with a disability, with what the Social Security Administration classifies as a mental disability. The vast majority had intellectual disability. And you can see this huge drop, so that today only a very small fraction of children receiving SSI receive it for intellectual disability. And what's replaced it largely is ADHD in yellow there, but also autism and learning disabilities and speech and language. So this is, I think, additional evidence of diagnostic substitution. There aren't huge numbers of more children with disability. It's a gradual rise, but it's a change in what they're being classified as having. And then from a global perspective, we also see some evidence of diagnostic substitution, I think, in that the way that the DALYs, the disability adjusted life years, are computed. This is a measure used in global health to capture the burden of disease in a population. If you just go to their website, it's at the University of Washington, You can plug in different diseases, and it'll give you a graph of the trends. And when you plug in autism, you get this rising number of disability-adjusted life years globally due to this. You put in intellectual disability, and this is the only category they had, and you see this big drop. The only basis for this is, these aren't real data, but it's based on expert panels' opinions about what the burden of disease is across the world. And this is actually being used, this scheme is being used to channel resources, though, for different types of diseases and using it to prioritize different diseases globally. So it does have impact. And then I mentioned diagnostic accretion, which is the idea that children with can have multiple different diagnoses, much more today than was true in the past. And just to give you some examples of how that happens, we had a talk in Wisconsin recently by Robert Steiner, who is an authority on, and he spent his whole career researching this, this disorder, Smith-Lemli-Opitz syndrome, a very rare genetic disorder. And these kids have intellectual disability and other issues. And he said it was just a few years ago that his neuropsychologist came to him and said, did you know that all your kids have autism? And, you know, I don't think you could say that they didn't in the past, but it wasn't considered. And they wouldn't have had a staff person trained to diagnose it and then the awareness of it and that sort of thing. So I think there's no doubt that to some extent the increase we're seeing is due to that. Cerebral malaria. In Africa, there's studies out of Kenya showing that children surviving cerebral malaria have autism. That's probably been true. If it's true now, it's probably been true for a long time, but they weren't being diagnosed and nobody was considering the possibility. So I wanted to just shifting away from reasons for the increase and some of the knowledge about the epidemiology and risk factors for autism. One of the things we did with our surveillance data from the ADAM network was to look to see, there's a lot of interest in the new diagnostic criteria, the DSM-5, and whether it's going to reduce the number of children receiving services for autism disorders and number that are eligible. What we tried to do was just look to see how it might affect prevalence. So that's really all we can do with our surveillance data. That's the main thing we can do. And basically what we did was we retrospectively used the DSM-5 criteria and went back over two of our previous study years where we did the surveillance based on TSM-4 and just to see what impact would it have on the prevalence adopting these new criteria. And what we found was that it's not a huge impact. It's about, this is the trend line. All right, this line is the actual prevalence as it was measured in our ADAM surveillance sites and showing the rise. And then this is, for the 2 years where we applied the DSM-5, this is the difference. So we did find that it would reduce the prevalence by about 19%, but that it's not going to make the trends go away. And it's not really a huge, we're not going to go back to 1970 when, you know, it was 2 per 10,000. And what we ended up concluding was that probably as diagnostic practices change and adapt to the new criteria, the effect will be less than this because we were relying on what behaviors were documented in the medical records, and that will change as diagnosticians use the new criteria. So we ended up concluding it's probably not going to have much of an effect on the prevalence, but we'll have to see what happens. It's something that's being debated. Another thing I wanted to just mention in our one of the things that is unique about our autism surveillance methodology is that we don't rely on children having a diagnosis already in their records. We try to apply a surveillance methodology to identifying it. So we have a team of clinician reviewers who look at all the records with the same eye and try to just decide whether it meets criteria. And that way, we can monitor these trends over time. It's not that we're changing our ideas about our classification scheme each year. We're using the same one, but we still see the rise. So that every year there's a proportion of children, and it's about 20%, who don't actually have a diagnosis of autism anywhere in their record, but they do meet the surveillance criteria, and so they're included in the numbers of the prevalence. And it's just that fact that we do that has allowed us to do some studies, which I'm going to mention this one that Paul Shattuck led, which is to look at the timing of diagnosis in children with autism and what factors are associated with it. And for this study, we used like a survival approach, realizing that about 20% didn't have, by the age of 8, did not yet have a diagnosis. So it factors in. So really, we do like the median age then, including those who didn't have a diagnosis at all. When in our CDC prevalence reports, we don't do the survival approach. We just report among children with autism with a diagnosis what was the median age that they got that diagnosis. And it's about 4.5 years, which is really late, right, as any autism expert would tell you. But when you factor in those who still hadn't had a diagnosis at all, it's actually 5.7 years is the median age that children in the population are getting a diagnosis of autism. And so obviously this leaves a huge, opportunity for improvement and for providing, improving our early identification and providing services at an earlier age so that it can have some benefit. I think this finding has helped drive some of the focus on screening and mass screening as an approach. And that is a classic public health approach to problems, is to have mass screening or mass anything, something that's available for everybody in the population. And the American Academy of Pediatrics has advocated this. It remains to be seen to what extent it's being implemented around the country. Another thing we did with our autism data that looked also at the age from the surveillance data, applying this survival analysis to look at the age at which the factors that affect the age at earliest diagnosis. And this analysis was led by Matt Naner at the Weissman Center. And basically what he did was figure out that using the DSM-4 criteria for autistic disorder, there are 616 different ways that a child can meet the criteria by different combinations of behaviors. And he hypothesized that the specific combination that you have would be associated with the age at identification. And in fact, it was. And the main finding, I think, from this report was that there were differences in the children who had a very late diagnosis were more likely to meet the diagnostic criteria for autism by having impairments in peer relations and conversational ability and speech. And if you think about it, it's not so easy to diagnose those things at age 18 months or something like that. So much of the effort that's saying, since we can diagnose autism in 12-month-olds, then we should be able to diagnose all autism at age 12. And I think what we see from this is it's not so easy, and that as we go along and the later the age at identification, the more likely it is that they met the criteria with these other things which don't show up until a later age. And so one of the things we've seen in our autism surveillance is that over the years that we've been doing this, we have not seen any change in that median age at diagnosis. It's not changed at all. And some people think, well, then that means we're not making any progress. But the reality is many more children are being diagnosed with autism at a younger age. It's just that we're also identifying many more of this later age. And so on average, it balances out, and there's no change in the median age. So it's just a nuance. And I don't know if it's true that we can identify all kinds of autism as early as 12 months. So it's just an implication of the finding. Now, I wanted to switch and talk a little bit about what we know about autism from a global perspective. And this is a map that shows, basically, it's a map of the number of cases identified with autism in epidemiologic studies by country. And what you can basically see is that all the areas in white there's never been a case in the systematic review that I mentioned earlier of epidemiologic studies of autism. There's never been a single case included in an epidemiologic study from those countries. And in the United States, we take the cake with, and it's partly because I think of our Adam network that we have the most largest number of children included in epidemiologic studies. But there are many, in addition to Adam's study, there are many other epidemiologic studies, of course. And the UK comes in second. They actually have the most studies, but their studies are smaller than ours. And so Europe is fairly well represented, Australia. But most of the world, there is no information on the prevalence or risk factors for autism. And this is a graph shows kind of proportionally where people in the world live. And actually, almost 90% of children in the world live in low and middle income countries, those same countries that are white on the earlier map where we have no information. And we're all in the foreseeable future, or at least till 2050, where the world growth in population is expected to occur is in those countries where we have very little limited information about autism. But we think that there's reason to think that it is a huge and emerging problem in these countries. And one of the factors is that we're seeing we've had huge success in the Millennium Development Goals about improving child survival in the last couple of decades. And I've been working with colleagues in Bangladesh and a number of other low and middle income countries monitoring the prevalence of disabilities in children. And we hypothesize that with these improvements in survival, we'll see a rise in the prevalence of disability. And I think the best evidence of that comes from Bangladesh, where they've had some of the most dramatic declines in child mortality over the decades. And they also, that's one country where we've been able to do some prevalent studies of disability generally, not autism specifically. And we find a corresponding increase in prevalence. So that, just this general relationship is one reason why we think that the prevalence of autism is probably rising dramatically in low and middle income countries. We did a study with UNICEF where they incorporated the 10-question screening tool into their MIX program where they do surveys of child health in countries, all in low and middle income countries around the world. And the countries the areas shown in red on this map are where they did these studies, and they did include many of the countries where there hadn't been any epidemiologic information. And what they found was that the median percentage of children screening positive for disability was 24% in these countries, which is really high. But they didn't have the resources to do any diagnostic assessments. So these are just screening results. We can't tell which disability the children had. But it suggests that the prevalence of developmental disabilities is really high in countries, and it's consistent with what we would expect, in part because the systems in place to prevent known causes of disability are not happening in these countries. So that's just another reason to think that the prevalence could be quite high. And then I just want to mention that, just as a background, before we talk about how we could address autism in these countries, is just to remember that in most countries of the world, and they're shaded in white here, their annual expenditures on health care per capita are less than $2 a day. So in most countries of the world, and where most people live, it's really less than $500 a year for their annual per capita expenditure. And this is all health care. This is preventive medicine and treatment for all kinds of diseases. And so it just sort of puts it in perspective as to that's the kind of budget that might be available for addressing autism and other developmental disabilities. When we look at the cost of autism in the United States, where the services, I think, are the most developed, some of the most developed globally, we see that it costs over $2,000 just to get a diagnosis in this country. And then the therapeutic services are $50,000 or more, the ones that are shown to be the most effective. Autism is also the most expensive category of special education services in the country, in the United States. And the healthcare costs an analysis of data from Kaiser showed that families of children with autism had healthcare costs for all kinds of things that were more than three times higher than for children without autism, and the lifetime estimate of what it costs for a person to have autism in this country, over and above what it costs to live a life anyway, is $3.2 million. So given that situation and trying to think about how we're going to address autism in low and middle income countries is just staggering, and I think we clearly need new models and new methods before we can even begin to do the screening and figure out how to address it. I want to take a minute and just talk about the relationship between socioeconomic status and the prevalence of autism. The idea that autism is more common in people of high education and family, offspring of parents that are highly educated or affluent families, has been around since the very first descriptions of the disease back in the 1940s. Leo Kanner, in his first report, went into great detail about the educational backgrounds and the accomplishments of the parents of all the children in his sample. And I think that for the first epidemiologic studies, too, they did focus on, and even our first study from Wisconsin, they described the educational and showed that there more autism in children with highly educated parents at that time as well. And this was before it was a desirable diagnosis or before there were treatments available. But there was a paper that Lorna Wing wrote in 1980 where she kind of addressed this question head on and argued that there is no excess prevalence of autism in affluent families. It's just purely that a knowledgeable and determined parent is more likely to get an accurate diagnosis. And so that after this paper, none of the reviews of the prevalence of autism or the epidemiology would brought up again that autism was more common in the high-income families or anything like that. But we wanted to look at it since we had this population-based prevalence data. We did a study just in our Wisconsin data looking at, do we find evidence that it's more prevalent in the high social class families? And we were surprised to find that it was. And this pattern where it shows a stepwise increase in prevalence with increasing social class is the reverse of what you see for any other developmental disorder. If there is a relationship with social class at all, it's in the opposite direction. So it's a really unusual finding, actually. And we then decided to try to do it for the ADAM network overall, where we have much more diverse sample and a large enough sample where we could stratify by race, ethnicity. And we found, going back to that earlier finding where we said our surveillance data consistently shows non-Hispanic white children to have a higher prevalence than black children or Hispanic children. We wondered, is this because of social class? And so if you could stratify by these ethnic groups and then look in, do we see any evidence? And basically what this slide shows is that it probably is related to the social class differences. In the high social class, the third bar in each of these groups, you can see that there's no shortage of autism in other ethnic groups. It's just as common. It's just that there are fewer children that are in the high social class in those groups. So this really does suggest it's confounded by socioeconomic status. Now, but still, I mean, what does that mean? One of the things we looked at, because in the ADAM network, we have sites that only access data from the health records. We have sites that get both school and health records. And then we have, all the sites that have school also use health records, but some of them only identified cases through the schools. So we stratified and looked at whether we would see this socioeconomic gradient in each, whether they were identified through the schools, through the health, or both. And for this, we were assuming that because in the United States we do have universal access to schooling and special education, we might not see the socioeconomic gradient in the school sources, but we'd see it more in the health-related. But what we found was very similar. What this shows is in each time, the medium SES was the reference group, and the prevalence was significantly lower with a relative risk 0.7 in each of these categories, and it was significantly higher in the high SES. So basically we're saying the same gradient is present in schools and in health-related sources. And I mean, this could still be, Lorna Wing could still be right that it takes a knowledgeable parent in the school system to and determined parent to get the child access to services within the school system as well. I don't know. But there are a number of, I think, important implications from this SES autism gradient that we find in our ADAM data. And one is that if we assume that Lorna Wing is right and this gradient is entirely due to disparities in access to services and access to the diagnosis, then the conclusion is that there are many underserved children in the country, and so this is an important implication, I think, right, just in and of itself. It also suggests that our current estimates of prevalence are actually still underestimates. So 1 in 68, if that does not include children of low socioeconomic status, it's probably considerably higher than this. And, of course, as I mentioned, the apparent difference in autism prevalence by ethnicity is probably more related to the socioeconomic differences. So that's one set of implications. I think there's another implication of this. It could be that it's not just that higher socioeconomic families are able to get into the services more, but there's some evidence that clinicians trained in the Connors criteria and so on might be biased in who they provide diagnoses for. This wouldn't explain our result because we don't rely necessarily on an existing diagnosis, but Kukuro and colleagues found that they sent vignettes to clinicians of children with different kinds of symptoms. And the only change they made, in some of them they changed the race of the child, and in others they changed the economic and educational background of the parents. And what they found, there was no bias by race. Whether the child's race was changed didn't affect the likelihood of assigning an autism diagnosis. But they did find that the educational background of the parents affected whether the child had an autism diagnosis. So another example I wanted to give sort of the linguistic barriers. And Sandy Magana, who used to be at the Weissman Center, is now at the University of Illinois Chicago. She looked into sort of what are the mechanisms and processes, because in our data we have very low prevalence in Hispanic families. And she found that there are these systematic ways in which their age at which they get the diagnosis is delayed. And they actually frequently don't get the diagnosis until after age 8. And in Wisconsin, to be eligible for the state-funded services for autism, you have to have a diagnosis by the age of 8. So Latino families were being systematically excluded from services, even though the need was just as great as other families. So she wrote a really interesting paper about this, and it's something that in public health has been discussed for decades. It's this idea that as technologies become available, it will increase disparities. Because unless the access to those technologies, specific efforts are made to make the access equitable. So for things like newborn screening that we have, every baby gets screened pretty much. You know, there's not a disparity there. But when you have to have a very active parent who is able to find it, that kind of thing, then you get the disparities in health associated with it. So that's basically the conclusion from her paper. It was interesting. I wanted to just mention that one of the things we had hoped is that over time, what this shows is that went back and coded the ADAM data from 2000 forward in terms of this SES gradient again, because we'd kind of hypothesized that as we see the rising prevalence over these years, it's possible that we're greater awareness that this disparity is declining. We would hope that if it is due to a disparity, there is more effort for developmental screening and so on. So could we see some evidence of a decline? And so far, we don't. If anything, we're seeing an increase in the disparity over time. And maybe this is just because these recommendations for routine screening are relatively new. They take a long time to begin to actually adopt. There haven't been studies that I know of that look at how well they are actually being implemented. So it may just be that it's going to take time to even out. But so far, we don't see evidence that the the gradient is going away. And then I think there are some other possible implications of the, if we don't think it's all due to the detection bias, or as Lorna Wing called, selection bias, you know, it is possible that there's something in the physical or social environments of children living in higher, more affluent families that could increase the risk. I mean, we don't think we can rule that out. There's the hygiene hypothesis, and there's a lot of interest in the immunologic factors associated with autism. It's been shown in asthma that children that are, you know, raised in less like clean, sterilized environments have a lower risk of asthma because they're exposed to more things early on. So maybe there is something in that that could be associated here. Also, there could be biological factors like parental age. There is an association between parental age and education, and so some of that could be like working together. I mean, I think it's possible that that could enhance the parental age effect, in that if you have an older parent, then their child is more likely to have autism. They're also more likely to be able to get services, be able to have resources to be able to access the service and more knowledge and that sort of thing. So these things could be working together. There could be some other confounding factor that we don't know about that's associated with both high SES and increased risk of autism. I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that this SES gradient is not universal. In Sweden, where they have really good data, population-based data, they don't find it. They don't really find a significant association with socioeconomic status. If anything, it's higher prevalence in the lower social class. This, again, points to the possibility that it's due to a lack of universal access in this country to services for children with autism. I wanted to just mention that globally, there's huge interest in autism now and the possibility that it's increasing. And it's just been very interesting because the perspective on autism and disability in general is very different globally than it here is in this country. And what's happened is last year, both the World Health Assembly and the United Nations, they both passed resolutions calling for more research and more services, more focus on autism in populations across the country, across the world. And what I was told by the World Health Organization has held a couple of meetings on this, and what they explained to us was that they've been wanting to focus on autism for some time, but they can't until there's a resolution like this, because they're basically do what the countries want them to do. And so now that this has been passed, it's really opened up the door to more of a global focus on autism and ensuring that services are available for children and that we get a better understanding of the causes and all of that stuff. So that's happening globally. But the perspective is very different than it is in this country. And globally, the perspective on disability is much more of a human rights perspective. So it's for example, there's this Convention on the Rights of the Child and the Convention on the Rights of People with Disability. These really direct a lot of the work going on in these international organizations related to autism and disability, which is basically sees the children with disabilities as having a right to a full and decent life, that sort of thing. And so I think it's been described as a paradigm shift. Instead of viewing people with disabilities as objects of charity or medical treatment or protection, they're seen as people with rights, and the focus is more on protecting their rights and access to services and school and work environments and things like that. So that's been a big focus of the work internationally, I think. It's also in line with the International Classification of Functioning, which I don't think is used very much in this country, but it is the major way of defining disability in global health. And the idea is that disability is a multidimensional concept, and there's impairment at the bodily level, or it might be what we measure with an IQ test or that sort of thing. And then there's actual limitations in activity or functional limitations, and then restrictions in participation. And the emphasis in this scheme is that it's not just the impairment that matters, but we need to be focusing on functioning and improving the participation in society. And so I'd say that's much more the focus globally. Unfortunately, I think, and this is where I think the epidemiology of autism has been very restricted, we focus only on this dimension in epidemiologic studies, I'd say. And the tools we have available focus on the impairment dimension. And in order to be considered a case, you have to meet criteria on that dimension. But there's almost no information. We have no information in our surveillance system on functional status or anything like that. Not to mention the participation restriction, which is a whole other dimension of disability. So I just mentioned this. I think we don't have available measures or ways to incorporate them yet into our surveillance system for autism. Although we have been making progress, we also do surveillance of cerebral palsy. And we've recently been able to incorporate the gross motor functioning scale, which is a measure of gross motor functioning, into the surveillance system and then get a lot of information on the level of functioning of the children. It's not just a yes or no case. And I have brought this up previously, the idea that one of the problems globally is that the measures and tools we have available for epidemiologic studies of autism are proprietary and they're very expensive. And you have to pay per person identified. And so there's been a call for developing tools that are more open source, open access, and our program is used for statistical analysis. But it's become like a global phenomenon in that it's used now all over the world. The best statisticians would prefer to use R. It's like a global community of collaboration where you can develop tools, programs for particular types of analysis, post them and share them. People are free to adapt them for different uses. And I just put this up as a model because I think this is the kind of approach we need in order to address the global disparity in autism knowledge, because right now you can't just take a tool and translate it or adapt it for use in a different country because of the licensing issues. You'd be breaking the law if you did that. Instead, you have to pay huge fees, and then there's restrictions on being able to adapt it. And when you're working cross-culturally, it's important to be able to adapt items for the local context, not to mention the language translation as well. There's Matt Mayner, who's now at the CDC as a EIS officer, and fellow. He has developed this website to try to foster international collaboration and sharing of tools for measuring disability that include functional and participation measures as well as impairment, where people can share the tools and adapt. And there are a number of tools for neurodevelopment in general and developmental disabilities that are in the public domain and or that might be freely available, and some of these are listed here. So this is a movement going on globally, and it's one of the things that's going to help fill this need for better information and better assessment of autism globally. And actually, without this approach, I'm not sure what we'll do, really. So I wanted to just also mention that there's in terms of improving the functioning of people with autism and other disabilities and their participation in society, there's a lot of technological innovations that have been occurring for motor and sensory impairments, but less so for the kind of impairments and functional limitations in autism. But I think this is, and actually I would change this now after my visit here at the Mind. I know that there's many different technological innovations occurring here that do address the symptoms and limitations in people with autism. So I think this might fit in with a focus not only on trying to prevent the impairment, but how can we enhance the functioning and participation of people with autism with these technological. There's also been a movement internationally to, and it's based on a human rights perspective on autism, that everybody should have the right to work. And people with autism are no different, and we should be doing more to make the match between different employment opportunities and the special skills that many people with autism have. And so Specialist Eastern has been developed in Denmark, but I think this is a global trend and has global reach. It was written up in the New York Times, and one of the famous couple with wrote this letter to the editor. People with autism are no different than anyone else. They want a job, home, and friends. So I think this trend, it started more globally, but I think it should be influencing autism here in the United States as well. I wanted to also mention just how autism has been limited in this sort of translational research process, I think, compared to other kinds of developmental disabilities and other work. Something that the CTSAs here in the United States are focusing on more are these different levels, phases of translational research from discovery into actually affecting the population and then monitoring those effects. And just to give you an example, in something like neural tube defects, we've been able to use epidemiologic findings to identify the association between folate deficiency, maternal folate deficiency, and risk for neural tube defects. That's more of a phase one discovery, and then showing also that supplementation or fortification of the food supply can actually prevent neural tube defects. But then phase two is developing population-level policies to implement that, whatever knowledge we had from the discovery. And we've seen that happen in neural tube defects with folic acid. With phase three is then looking to see, sort of taking it to scale in the population. So not, we knew, we showed it worked, but now can we actually implement it on a population level? And then phase four is did it have an impact? So I think in neural tube defects, this has come full force, and then we've been able to use the epidemiologic data to show that it actually has reduced the frequency of neural tube defects in the population. In autism, it's very different. I think all of our discoveries so far are for the most part, in phase one, where we're making discoveries about factors that are associated with autism, and sometimes moving to phase, especially with developmental screening, we've moved to phase two, where we've used that to develop policies that all children should be screened for developmental disabilities, including autism, at regular periods. But we haven't gotten beyond that, I don't think, with any of the discoveries in autism, based on at least on the population-based discoveries, where we don't really see whether it's being implemented at a population level. And we certainly haven't seen evidence of any of the effects, I would say, at this point. But I think this is the agenda we have going forward, and we need to do a lot more work in this area, both here in the U.S. and globally. So just to summarize, I would say the epidemiologic studies show the prevalence of autism has definitely increased in recent decades, and I would think that we're probably heading at something like 2% of children meeting diagnostic criteria, at least as they currently exist, for autism in populations where it's studied, where you can study it. But our service delivery system is certainly not prepared to meet this need at this point in time. And I think everywhere in this country there's waiting lists for diagnostic services and other services for autism. So having this information should help us to prepare a little better to meet this need, at least. But there's a need for ongoing monitoring, especially to see the disparities in access to services and how we can correct what the sources of those are and how we can correct them. There's need to monitor to what extent the screening policies are being implemented and allowing earlier detection and early intervention. We need ongoing monitoring and discovery of the risk factors and causes, and also of the potential impacts of the new criteria on eligibility. I mean, I think we will need to monitor that, even though I don't think it's going to affect prevalence very much. And then we need more work looking at the health and quality of life of people with autism and the transition. If now 2% of children have autism, what about when they transition to adulthood, and what effects is this going to have, and are we ready for this kind of a change? And then in conclusion, I just want to also reiterate that most of our knowledge of autism is based on studies in high-income countries and high-income communities, even within this country, I think. And even though the vast majority of people affected are probably in low and middle-income communities. And so the solutions we develop, we need ones that are going to be more applicable to low and middle-income communities. Also, I think with the convergence of ideas and new technologies, I think it's more possible than previously that we could actually begin to meet the needs, and I can see a world where we'll be more inclusive of people with disabilities and people with autism in the workforce and so on. But in order to achieve this, autism research, especially the epidemiologic research, needs to be expanded to include low and middle income communities and a more broader definition of disability and inclusion of measures of functioning, which we don't have really good accessible measures of these at this point in time. So thank you very much, and I'm happy to take any questions.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.